So, hello to everybody to our last session, the concluding session of our wonderful conference. Will include three talks of invited speakers, starting with Susie Moat. She is a professor of behavioral science at Warwick Business School, and she is a co-director of the Data Science Lab in Warwick. And that's one of the reasons we are very interested to listen to her talk, because she is one of the colleagues interested in working hard on the usage of internet data, of tracking data, to explain and describe human behavior in different contexts. We are very proud to have you here. The floor is yours.
Yeah, good. Thank you very, very much for the kind invitation. It's an absolute delight to be here. The conference so far has been fascinating. So my name is Susie Moat. I'm a professor of behavioral science at Warwick Business School. And I'm also a fellow of the Alan Turing Institute, which is the UK's national institute for data science and AI. Now, my background is a mixture of computer science and psychology. And for very many years, people used to tell me that this was a bit of an odd combination. But as you all know, things have really changed over the past few years. And increasingly, everything we do generates data. Now, at Warwick Business School, I have the huge honor of directing the Data Science Lab with my colleague, Tobias Price. And in our Data Science Lab, we're interested in data from the internet. So data on things people are searching for on Google, data on photos people post to sites like Instagram or Flickr, or even data from games that people play online. Now, over the past few years, we've asked a lot of questions of this data. We've looked at whether we can use this data to predict human behavior. We've looked at whether we can use it to measure human behavior that was previously incredibly expensive or just very time consuming to capture. And we've also looked at whether we can use this data with a little bit of help from AI to help us measure things that we simply couldn't measure before. And that's what I'm going to tell you about today. So, this is a picture of the Lake District in the UK. Now, I grew up not too far from the Lake District. And I used to really love spending time there because it's beautiful. And just being in this beautiful space made me feel better. Up there in the top right-hand corner, that's Chinuki Sarasinghe. Chinuki is a fantastic researcher. She's just finished her PhD in our lab. But before she came to study with us, she had a really interesting career doing a number of things, including running her own design agency. So Chinuki has a real sense of how the way places look might impact the way we all feel. So Chinuki, Tobias Price and I, we were looking at photos like this. We were looking at the huge volumes of photographs that people now put online. And we were wondering, is there not a way to use this kind of data to start to get some sort of quantitative insight into the relationship between the way places look and how healthy we all feel? Now, unfortunately, I did not used to have the luxury, nor do I now, of spending all my time on holiday in the Lake District. We all have to work. And so the important question is probably about how healthy people are in the places that they live. And in the UK, we're very lucky. We have some great data on that, thanks to the Office for National Statistics. Now, in the UK, every 10 years, we have a census. And one of the questions on that census asks people to report on how good their health is. And you can answer everything from very good to very bad. And so we can plot that data. Now, before we do, we have to take a few things into account. So you might realize people who are older tend to report their health to be worse. So we need to take into account how old people are in different regions. Turns out men actually tend to report their health as worse than women. So we have to take into account how many men and women live in each area. But once we've done that, we get a map of this kind. And so lighter areas are areas where people reported their health to be worse. Darker areas are areas where people reported their health to be better. And so if you take a look, you can see pretty rapidly that we've got clusters of people reporting their health to be poorer around big cities such as London or Birmingham or Manchester, for example. So we've got this sort of nation-scale data on how healthy people feel. But how on earth can we get data at that scale on how beautiful different places are? Now, the answer to this question, thankfully, came to us in the shape of a game called Scenic or Not. So Scenic or Not was made by My Society, an organization back in 2009. And I'm very happy to say it now lives in our data science lab at Warwick. And Scenic or Not shows you pictures like this one and asks you to rate them between 1 and 10. So if you think this picture is really scenic, you can give it 10. If you think it's awful, you can give it 1, or you can pick something in between. And those pictures, in turn, they come from another game called Geograph, where people get points for uploading pictures in as many kilometer squares as possible across Great Britain. So on the back of Scenic or Not and Geograph, we have over 1.5 million ratings for 200,000 locations across Great Britain. And so we can map that data too. So if you map the data, this is what it looks like. Darker areas are areas that were rated as more scenic. That dark purple area up in the north is the Lake District, so I was delighted to see everybody agreed with me. Down in the south, looks like we should be spending our holidays in Cornwall, also doing very well. But on the whole, you see some patterns. So you might recognize in the southeast a rather light blob, and that's, of course, London. So London's not scoring as well as we might imagine. So what we wondered is, okay, well, what would we see if we put this data together with the data on how healthy people had reported themselves to be? And the answer was that people who lived in areas that were rated as more scenic were reporting their health to be better. Now, if you've just been looking at those two maps, I'm sure you're all thinking, well, aren't there some absolutely massive confounds here? I mean, for example, we just saw that in big cities like London, people were reporting their health to be worse. In those big cities, we're not getting the Lake District scores. So, you know, this could be something really simple about whether people live in the city or the country. Now, we wondered that too. And so we split England into urban, suburban, and rural areas and looked at whether this relationship held in those areas on their own. And we found it did. So for example, even if you just look at urban areas where you're not going to get those high scores like you do in the Lake District, the differences in the ratings still help us gain a better explanation of how healthy people report themselves to be. Now, even with that out of the way, you might think, well, yes, but who lives in the areas in cities that look a bit more attractive? Surely it's the people with more financial resources. We wondered that too, but you'll realize, thankfully, we have a lot of data on demographic characteristics like income, again, thanks to the ONS. So we were able to put that sort of data into our model so that we could take that into account. And while it is sadly the case, you know, lower incomes associated with people reporting their health to be worse, it isn't enough to explain this relationship. Now, even with that out of the way, if you're looking at this photograph, you might think, well, yes, but have you not found a really complicated measure with your data here? Is this maybe not just about how attractive places are, but simply how green they are? I mean, you might agree with me that this is a beautiful place, but you're definitely not going to disagree with me that it's a very green location. And so we wondered that too. Indeed, people have thought about the relationship between green space and well-being in the past. The reason people have looked at green space and well-being in the past is because it has traditionally been much easier to measure. So you can use satellite photography, or rather aerial photography, to work out how green a location is, so we can generate some measures, plot it, and it looks like this. Now, if you look at that map, you see, well, yes, the Lake District is very green, as we could have inferred for ourselves. And indeed, there's some similarities between this map and our map of how attractive different places were. But if you put them next to each other, these maps are not exactly the same. Say, over towards the east, for example, you see areas that don't score as well in terms of how scenic they are, but they're doing very well in terms of how green they are. So what we wondered is, okay, which one of these metrics is going to help us best explain how healthy people report themselves to be? So we built three models, all using our control variables, our demographic variables. In one model, we looked at the green space data. In another model, we looked at the scenicness data. And in a third model, we put both of these data sets in together. And what we see is that if you want the best possible explanation of how healthy people report themselves to be, there's very little evidence that we can afford to ignore the data on aesthetics. So the size of these bars represents roughly the amount of evidence we have for each of these models as amongst them as a set. Green is the evidence for the green space only model, and you can see hardly any of these bars are green across all the different areas. And in fact, in the urban area in particular, by this analysis, the model we have the most evidence for is the model that's drawing on the scenicness data alone. Across all of them, evidence that we should be using the scenicness data, perhaps with the green space data. Now, I should be really clear about something at this point. This is quite clearly a correlation. It's not the case that I can stand here at this point and claim that we've shown that living in a more scenic environment causes people to feel healthier. So, for example, one thing that we can't yet rule out is that people who feel healthier one day wake up and decide to move to a more attractive location. And trying to get these sorts of things out of the way, investigated, is something we're working on at the moment. But even if we did have genuinely causal evidence of a relationship between how attractive a place was and how healthy people reported themselves to be, there are still questions we might want to ask. Specifically, why? Why might we have this relationship? Is it because people who live in more attractive locations are more likely to go out and do some exercise? Or is it perhaps that people who live in more attractive locations feel happier, and this happiness makes them feel healthier in turn? Now, happiness is an interesting topic because that has also traditionally been very difficult to measure. So, for example, you could run an experiment, you could take a couple of groups of people, put them in two different situations, ask them how happy they were before and afterwards. But the problem with that sort of approach is we tend to have fairly low numbers of people and a low number of scenarios that we can consider. We could try running a survey, and indeed people have done this, so asking thousands of people how happy they feel. But traditionally, the effort required to do this has been so considerable that people only get asked, say, once a year. And so that sort of data doesn't give us insight into the day-to-day changes in our life that might affect how happy we feel. So for this reason, we were delighted to start working with George McCarron from the University of Sussex, who had developed an app called Mappiness. So Mappiness pings you a couple of times a day, and it asks you how happy you feel. It also asks you who you're with and what you're doing. And on the back of this Mappiness data, we have 3 years of measurements for 15,000 people and regularly reporting on how happy they felt. Now, if you have that scale of data, you start to see some patterns. So, for example, It's maybe a good job I gave my talk today rather than yesterday. Hopefully you're all feeling a little happier. In terms of months, it could have been worse. I'm not sure you would have wanted me to interrupt you in the summer. But these sorts of simple patterns aside, this sort of regular contextual measurement of how happy people are allows us to ask something we really couldn't before. Are people genuinely happier in more attractive locations? And the answer is that they are. And crucially, that holds even if we take into account how green an area is, even if we take into account whether it's a built or a natural area, even if we look at whether it's urban, suburban, or rural. So again, it holds in cities. Even in cities where you don't get these high scores, people still report themselves to be happier when they're in more attractive locations. And the advantage of being able to really measure environmental aesthetics, scenicness, and measure how happy people are means that we also get quantitative insights into how big the change is. So we can see that we might expect if somebody moved from the least scenic area to the most scenic area, that they'd report a change in happiness that is around the size, maybe a little bigger than the change you'd see if somebody was listening to music. Similar again to the change if they were talking, chatting, or socializing. The inverse of the slump that we all report, apparently, when we're traveling or commuting. And again, there are considerably more variables in the full regression than this. And taking into account other things we've not discussed, like weather, for example, that is easy to pull in because we know where people were when they reported on how happy they were. So we've seen that people report themselves to be healthier when they live in more attractive locations. They report themselves to be happier when they're spending time in more attractive locations. And so we mentioned this to some planners. And they said, well, that's really nice. But what makes a place more attractive? And we said, we'll go and look at our pile of 200,000 photographs then. We thought, okay, we're not sure how we're going to approach this. Planners often interested in built environments that they can affect. So let's look at built urban environments. What have people reported as more attractive there? Ended up pulling out the photos with the highest ratings, looking at what was in them, and then sort of lamely waving them about and saying, well, we think people like bridges. Not really the kind of answer that we were going for when we'd done all of this quantitative work. But thankfully, as others have commented today, there's been other major changes over the past few years, and not only in the amount of data that's become available, but in the ability of computers to understand what that data represents. So for example, computers can now give us much more information than they used to about what is actually in a photograph. And so we thought, okay, well, can we, instead of trying to work with this big pile of 200,000 photographs ourselves, can we somehow use artificial intelligence to analyze what's in the photos? So that's exactly what we did. We passed all of our photographs, like this one, to a convolutional neural network called Places CNN that was developed by some researchers at MIT. Now, Places CNN, if you put in a photograph like this, it will tell you what sorts of things it thinks are in the photograph. So it's come up with things like valley or lake natural here, and what kinds of characteristics the scene might have. So for example, we've got here natural light. And in total, there's over 300 features that this convolutional neural network outputs for each photograph. And so we can put our 200,000 photographs in, get 300 features for each of them out, and then we finally have some numbers so we can start taking a more quantitative approach to this question of what really makes people rate photographs as more attractive. And to do that, we use a special kind of regression, which takes into account that you are going to see correlations between some of these features, like valley and lake natural. Specifically, we use an elastic net. Now, the first things which came out were a little on the obvious side. So, for example, the first things that we saw is, okay, turns out people like lakes, it's not just me. Similarly, they were giving the valleys high ratings. On the other side, photographs which had industrial areas in them were not scoring as well, nor were photographs that had buildings that the convolutional neural network thought looked like hospitals. So, seemed pretty obvious to start with, right? The natural places are doing really well, the built areas are not doing very well. We didn't really need a CNN to tell us that. But when we started to look at the areas that many of us live in, the built-up urban areas, we started to see that the pattern was a little bit more nuanced. So, for example, in those sorts of areas, you find that there are built elements that can improve the aesthetics of the scene. So, for example, buildings with character, such as cottages or castles. To my absolute delight, bridges. It really does come out. So viaducts, aqueducts, they were also boosting the score. And at the same time, it's not the case that all green spaces, natural spaces, are the same. So yes, if you've got trees in the scene, then that boosts people's rating of that scene. But if you have just plain grassy green areas, then those sorts of scenes don't score as well. So just thinking that it's green space is clearly too simplistic. It's not. There are built elements that can improve this score, and not all green and natural elements are going to boost it. So we were delighted that we had escaped our previous embarrassment at not being able to answer that question. But we couldn't help but wonder whether this couldn't go a bit further. And this comes back to one of the limitations of our original data set. So I mentioned on Geograph, people get points for rating and for uploading photographs in as many kilometer squares of Great Britain as they can. Now, scenic or not, building on that, in its original form, only had one rating for every kilometer squared. But there were way more photographs than that. And in urban areas, it would be really useful to have more dense measurements. So one possibility would be to just get people to rate a whole load more photographs. But we wondered, well, you know, if we've got a CNN that can tell us what's in the photograph, can we not also train a CNN to tell us how scenic the photograph is? And so that's what we did. We took Places CNN, and we essentially told it, well, stop trying to tell us what's in it, you know, build on what you knew before, but look at this scenic data and start learning the relationship between photographs and the rating that they've been given. So we use transfer learning over Places CNN. And if you do this, then we find you can create a convolutional neural network that does a pretty good job of estimating the ratings that humans give to photographs. So for example, this is a map that was created by our CNN. So each dot is the location of a photograph. So red dots are photos that the CNN didn't like so much, and blue dots are photos that the CNN really liked. Now, if you look at the map, you can see some obvious patterns. The CNN loves the parks, drawn blue dots all over them. But if you actually start looking in more detail at the data, then you see, again, the pattern is more nuanced than that. So if we ask the CNN, okay, what are your top 5% favorite locations in London? Then this is what we see. Indeed, places like Hampstead Heath, green natural places, getting great scores. But in that top 5%, we also see built locations like Big Ben or like the Tower of London. So just like what we'd seen in the scenic data, the CNN has learned that it isn't just natural elements that can boost the score of a scene, but some built elements can too. So to conclude, across all of this research, what we find is that scenic areas are not just green areas. Scenic areas are not just natural areas, but scenic areas do appear to be places that might have consequences for something that matters to us as much as our health and our happiness. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Susie, for this impressive and fascinating talk. And you're very much in time. Thanks a lot. So we have time for some questions.
Thank you. It's so nice to see a talk that focuses on beauty and happiness. It's a delightful thing for a Friday afternoon. So you might be familiar with this. There was this guy, Dennis Dutton, who studied things that are universally beautiful. And they started with the assumption, they analyzed a lot of pictures too, and they realized that blue is always there, right? And then they thought, well, maybe that's the thing. And then they analyzed it further, and they realized, no, it's actually water needs to be there, and a little bit of light, and a hill, and signs of life, and a street. So maybe that might supplement your findings. Thank you.
Yeah, no, thanks for that. We are always doing our best to try and fit these results into theories people have come up with before as to why we might prefer different environments, approaches people have taken to trying to understand these sorts of patterns. I think what we've got here that has just been really difficult to get before is really large scale data. Large scale imperfect data, but you know, it's bigger in scale than it was before. And so I think what we see reflects some of the patterns that you mention, but it also allows us to go beyond these sorts of basic or initial ideas that it's about natural elements. So we're not saying that natural elements are not associated with places looking better and therefore people reporting themselves to be healthier and happier, but it does seem to be more nuanced than that. And in many ways, that's good news, because it takes us, although we may want to be trying to do this for other climate-related reasons, it takes a long time to, you know, form a large natural environment, but we can take quicker steps to influence the aesthetics of the built environments we live in.
Yeah, thank you very much for the fascinating talk. I was wondering, you already hinted at it, that you're currently working on a project that basically looks at selection and causation, potentially. So I was wondering whether you can just say a little more about your current or future planned work on that.
No, thanks for this question. So the thorny topic of causality and how to address this here is always something I'm very, very happy to discuss with people. The approach we've taken so far is that really, what we need to move from a correlation result to a claim of causality is essentially to rule out the other explanations that could exist for the initial relationship. And so some of that has been trying to take out confounds. So, you know, I didn't talk about pollution, but we've looked at that sort of thing as well, whether that could help explain what we find. We have also started to look at data where we can see that people have moved house that might help us try to understand whether there is this sort of reverse effect that seems unlikely, but obviously we're not in the business of deciding whether it seems unlikely. We want to try and get quantitative evidence around that. So there's a lot of further explanations we're trying to work out, and we're also looking at how else we can exploit the fact that we can automatically infer the characteristics of the image, and whether we can go beyond the level of detail that I've shown you in these analyses to provide more nuanced advice to people who want to try and affect the environments that we live in.
Okay, thank you very much again, Susie, for this talk.
Thank you
for the questions.